Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:40 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 15th. And I thought that because today is Friday and it's the big picture long-term audio and video, that perhaps it would be a good thing to begin to talk about is currencies. This has been a very big week in terms of the currency markets because we've had a significant move in the pound. The Canadian dollar has had a very strong move. Then when we look at the yen, it continues to weaken, and it looks to be pulling back from this 110 yen level versus the dollar. Meanwhile, the euro remains really quite steady. And when we start to look at what are the currencies that are performing and which are those that aren't, then we can start to draw a thread. And what is increasingly evident is that we are getting a return to interest rate sensitivity. And that represents a change, because in the last decade, because interest rates have been so low, and they've been low everywhere, and they've been just going down, and there's still a number of jurisdictions have negative interest rates, not least Switzerland and Sweden, then we are at a point now where interest rates are starting to rise. And the currencies which have a trajectory of higher interest rates tend to be doing better. So the Turkish lira has got some of the highest interest rates anywhere, and it has been rallying just about all year. It has been, in fact, the best performing stock market so far this year. Best performing currency market this year. It's up 11.8%. The ruble is also a pretty firm, and so is the South African rand. But we can also see down at the bottom that it is two of the countries that have got negative interest rates. Their currencies have been impacted, and the Swiss franc and the Swedish krona are among the worst performing currencies so far. Now, the euro has been both up and down, and it is. In terms of returns, because interest rates are so low, then you are giving up some of the performance in terms of the total return. But when we look at the nominal price, it has been trending higher just about all year. And it's at 120, which is a psychological level. But when we look at this on the longer term chart, it is looking increasingly likely that the euro is breaking up and away from what was a two-year base formation. When we think about it in those terms, it isn't simply about interest rates, but the view as to what the trajectory of interest rates is likely to be, because the ECB is beginning to talk about tapering. We don't know how long it's going to take to taper, and this week the pound has been particularly strong because it's likely to be among the first of the very large economies that is likely to follow, especially in Europe, to follow the ECB, or excuse me, the Federal Reserve in raising interest rates. And it is up to almost 136 in here today, but that is an emphatic breakout from that little first step above the type 2 bottom. And it has now clearly broken the three-year downtrend. So this now represents a recovery trajectory for the pound following what was a really quite depressed level. And if we look at that on the really long term, the number of times that the pound has traded down as low as 120 is only one other time, in early 1985, and then we had a storming rally subsequent to that, which took it all the way up to $2. Now I don't think there's anybody really thinking that the pound is going to get to two, and certainly the UK economy doesn't particularly want to have a strong currency. But if inflation is picking up, then they will have little choice but to raise interest rates. And that is what we're also starting to see with the Canadian dollar. And let me see if I can show it to you against the convention and the other way around. We can see very clearly that the Canadian dollar has been rallying since June, and the Bank of Canada has raised interest rates twice in that period of time. So that's a pretty aggressive pace of interest rate hikes. So now they are at a point where people are starting to pay attention, that Now the downtrend evident since 2011 is over, and now we're on a recovery trajectory. And as long as it is holding that 80 cent level, we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. The renminbi, which had been really quite strong over the last 3 months, is now giving some of that up. It looks increasingly likely that the dollar is engaged in a mean reversion rally against the renminbi, and that could take it up to 6 3/4. Quite what happens at that juncture and how long we will get in terms of a consolidation subsequently is anybody's guess, but it is looking increasingly likely that the period of the renminbi strengthening is probably over for a while. Now, what I think is perhaps this is also a good time to look at the charts of some interest rate benchmarks. So, for example, Chinese interest rates have really gone nowhere at all for really quite some time. But when we start to look broadly at the Asian region, that there aren't many places that have been raising interest rates. That the one of the places that, and indeed when we look at New Zealand or indeed Australia, their interest rates are at historically low levels for their economies. And these are very depressed levels. And against a background where commodity prices are beginning to recover, then it is open to question just how long they're going to keep interest rates at such low levels. I wouldn't like to have to make that decision, considering that they're probably going to start getting inflationary pressures from commodity prices, and they have rather high housing prices, which are interest rate sensitive as well. So this is going to be, I think, a rather important decision for both New Zealand and Australia, with the RBA rate at 1.5%. That isn't very high, and it is already a very tight interest rate differential versus even the USA, which is at 1.25. So we have had an incredibly low interest rate environment for a long time. And emerging market currencies have been raising their interest rates. Now, this South African repo rate is not up to date, I realize now. But when we look at, for example, the Brazilian real, because they have had the improvement in their economy, they've been able to lower interest rates, which is confidence improving. But they're still very high at 8.25%. That's a significant interest rate differential relative to what everyone else has. But this trend that we have in the Fed's funds rate is very consistent, and it would suggest that we're probably going to get another interest rate hike before the end of the year. And when we look at the ECB, they are at zero, and they probably aren't going to move from zero for a while yet. Whereas the Bank of England is at 0.25%, and they're talking about pushing it back up again. And of course, they dropped it down to 0.25% after the Brexit vote, and now with inflation picking up, then they may have to push it back up to 0.5%. Then, of course, we have Switzerland, which is in negative territory. The Bank of Canada, which is back at 1% after two interest rate hikes since June, and that's obviously why we've had the loonie doing so well, and Sweden, which has also got these negative interest rates. And of course, the Hong Kong rate, despite increasing speculation out there in the market that the Hong Kong dollar's pegged to the US dollar is going to be abandoned, they're still moving in lockstep with the Federal Reserve. Norway's deposit rates are still very low. And then in Chile, we've had falling interest rates. Colombia is around 5%, and interest rates have been falling there, not rising. So interest rate differentials have been contracting in some countries, and indeed, when you look at Mexico, they've been widening. And at 7%, that is one of the things that is helping the Mexican peso to be one of the better performers in terms of interest rate differentials. So if we think about that, this is very different. This is completely something that people haven't had to worry about for nearly 10 years, that you could have an interest rate differential between currencies, and then that could actually influence their value. It's been rather the opposite consideration for much of the last decade. It's been more about how much money is one central bank going to print than the other. So it's almost the exact opposite of the interest rate differential. Whereas now we're moving into a period of time where people are starting to think about the inflationary impact of their investment decisions, or the impact that inflation will have on their investment decisions. And that is most particularly the case for the bond markets, because bond markets have been pretty sanguine about the potential for interest rate hikes. So when we look at, for example, the UK gilt, and it has been bobbling along around the 1% level for most of the year, and this is the third time that it has bounced from that 1% level. Anyone with a ruler can probably draw a trend line that takes us pretty much down to where we are right now. And if we look at what the potential is, that for 10 years you can get 1.3%. And Austria this year issued a 100-year bond in size. We've had a couple of other sovereigns issuing 100-year bonds, not least Ireland or Belgium or Argentina, but not in any large size, whereas Austria has issued a bond in the order of about 2 billion euro. And it was oversubscribed, and people are more than happy to give them a shed load of money and without any real hope of making a return on it. To think that we're going to have such an incredibly low interest rate environment for the next century is really quite a bet. And considering that, it's difficult to think about what markets are going to do in the next week or even the next few years. To think that we have any idea of what the market is going to do within the next century, and to only take a couple of percent in terms of the return for that, would seem to be rather incredible. But that is exactly the kind of contradiction that we get in markets when they are close to a peak, that people are willing to accept incredible contradiction. That is the hallmark of a crowd in a manic state. That you can see these contradictions in every major bull market, whether it is in the Japanese bull market in the 1980s, that the Imperial Palace in Tokyo really was worth more than the entire state of California, and of course that was ridiculous, or that everybody can hedge their exposure at the same time, and that contributed to the 1987 crash, or that everybody can hedge their exposure to interest rates, which was the credit default swap debacle in the credit crisis, or that earnings don't matter in the tech boom of the 1990s, or even the way that people are talking about Bitcoin right now, that it is going to supplant all other currencies, which is rather ambitious, and it has been subject to rather incredible volatility in here over the last week. But it did bounce from this 300, excuse me, 3,000 level in here today, and that represented the upper side of the underlying range. So we are in a period now, though, where it has become even more volatile than it was previously, and this is a much larger reaction than we've seen previously. So it would suggest that it, at the very minimum, this is a softening up, and then the potential is that we could be going sideways for a significant period of time, and that would be about the most benign scenario. The least benign scenario is that it collapses entirely, and that more countries, in addition to China, move against the Bitcoin exchanges. So there is certainly an element of this contradiction evident in some of these markets, but most particularly it's evident in the bond markets, where you are getting people literally betting that they know what the future is going to be 100 years from now, long after they'll be dead. So I think that when you think about it in those terms, we are in a rather rarefied territory. And if we look at the 10-year treasury, it it has been holding this downward bias in yields all year. But if the 10-year gilt is bouncing from 1%, the 10-year treasury is bouncing from 2%. And it is now testing the region of the trend mean, and it needs to break that downward bias evident since January in order to really confirm that we're back in a supply-dominated environment. But people are beginning to question whether we're not in a tightening cycle. And that is something that has been rather, I think, grudgingly accepted in the bond markets, because when we look at what the reaction of bond markets to Fed pronouncements that back in 2010 and even in 2013, we had these big moves in bond yields, but then the Fed didn't raise interest rates, and we had the end of QE2, and then we had QE3, and QE3 went on for a very long time. So when the bond market now hears that the Fed is going to start normalizing the size of its balance sheet, well, it's taken with a grain of salt. This is what I've described now for a number of months as the boy who cried wolf market, that the bond investors are simply not willing to countenance the possibility that we are in a tightening cycle. But the currency market is beginning to show us that. That if the currency markets are reacting in the fashion that they are reacting because of interest rate differentials, then that tells us that they're becoming interest rate sensitive. But the bond market is much more interest rate sensitive than the currency markets, and it's only barely beginning to react to that possibility. And I think that that is something that is seems to be missing in terms of people's appreciation of what's going on. Because what we are, and this is something that I think is really quite important, we really have to look at very long-term charts. That yields have been coming down since the early 1980s, and one has to question why. And of course, we have been in one of the most profound disinflationary periods in history. And it has been what has, I think, the things that have contributed to it are technological innovation and globalization. And what we are, and I think, you know, that there is, this is a very important chart. And there we are. It's wages and salaries as a percentage of GDP have been trending lower since the 1970s. So if wages as a percentage of GDP have been trending lower, and it has a very similar trajectory to bond yields, then that is something that I think is not simply a coincidence, but what happens if it's a correlation? What happens if the fact that the velocity of money has been trending lower since the 1990s isn't a coincidence, but also a correlation? And if we start to think about it in those terms, that we have incredible technological innovation, and it is contributing to incredibly impressive bull markets, not least in the Nasdaq 100, which is the home to some of the very largest companies. And the Nasdaq has been trading above, Nasdaq 100 at least, has been trading above its 2000 peak now for a fairly considerable period of time. And there is no evidence yet that this advance has ended. If we think about what the animating factors are in terms of the technology bull market, then it can be broken down into a number of different themes. But I think the most important point is that there is no logical end point, that we are in a period of a golden age of technological innovation, and there has been enormous progress made, and there is enormous progress to come, and that technology is inherently deflationary. So what that means, of course, is that we can do more with less, but that because the pace of technology is improving, that we're getting to a point where artificial intelligence, automation, and biotechnology are getting to a point where we are going to need fewer people to do the same amount of work. And that is occurring at a time when the global population is expanding. And with technological innovation, the number of jobs is going to increase. There are going to be completely new functions for people to fulfill. There are going to be incredible opportunities for young people who are tuned into technology to advance and to build out careers in the new era. But then there are also going to be significant proportions of people that are left behind, that have no real hope of taking part in the economy as it evolves, because we're moving away from a focus on manufacturing. And we're getting to a point where services are also being automated. And when we have a situation where people that are working in retail are working in light manufacturing are being automated, then that is going to create millions of people with no jobs. And of course, some of them will be absorbed into new sectors. But then there are also going to be those that are not. And we know what that looks like. We know what has happened to places like the north of England when the coal mines shut down. We know what happened to places like the Rust Belt in the US when heavy manufacturing closed down. And some people were able to benefit, and then there were generations of people that were left out. It's the same thing has happened in France, same thing has happened in Australia. And that is the big question. Because now, if we believe that the correlation between wages to GDP is in fact a correlation rather than a coincidence, then the rise in reactionism against the status quo is only beginning. The potential is that we could have people rebelling against the loss of their living standards because of globalization and technological innovation. It is already starting, but the pace of technological innovation is accelerating, which means that it's only likely to get worse. That means that it's likely to be beneficial for stocks, because the trend of technological innovation is most beneficial to the companies that are purchasing that technology, that can generate the productivity growth. But what it also means is that workers are going to start demanding higher wages. And I don't think that that is going to be a local phenomenon. We're already seeing that the pace of wage growth is accelerating in China. One of the reasons that inflation is picking up in the UK is because people are worried about the impact of inflation on wages, and they have to act against inflation now, because otherwise wage demands will proliferate. Average hourly earnings have not moved to a great extent yet in the USA. They're still only at a growth rate of about 2.5%. But if we start to think about this not simply in where we are today, but rather what is the likely trajectory, then we haven't had wage growth for a long time, and wages relative to GDP are very low. So it is not going to take a big move in order to really start to generate wage growth. And that is going to be fought tooth and nail by the process of automation, because obviously the higher wages move, the greater the incentive there is for automation. It is going to create not a class warfare, but a warfare between the working classes and the trend of automation. And automation will eventually win. And what that suggests is that there's going to have to be some kind of, in constitutional democracies, people can vote for better conditions. And that was one of the things that contributed to the genesis of the labor movement over 100 years ago. And that is potentially what we're heading up against now. That is what we're beginning to see in terms of interest rate policy in the bond markets. And the fact that if wages increase, that is inherently inflationary. And stock markets are among the best hedges against inflation. But of course, the other big hedge against inflation is gold. And gold prices are so far sustaining the move above $1,300. The most important thing, and I've reiterated this point on a number of occasions, but the most important thing that's happened in gold prices in a decade has been that breakout in 2016 that broke the almost 5-year progression of lower rally highs. And now we are in this what has been a volatile ranging phase for much of the last 18 months, and gold got up to test its 2016 peak this week and has paused, and we're getting some consolidation. The extent to which gold can find support in the region of the trend mean or around that $1,300 area is going to tell us a lot about its ability to potentially break successfully above $1,400 later this year. When we look at the London Metals Index, the LME Metals Index, then it is also pausing here, and we're getting at least some consolidation of what has been a very impressive run over the last while. But by and large, this looks like a recovery trajectory, and that as long as it is trading above the trend mean, then this is likely to be nothing more than a consolidation following a very impressive run. The big missing ingredient in terms of commodity outperformance has been oil. And Brent crude has been in a volatile range for 18 months, but it has broken the downward bias from this year, and it is pushing back up towards that $60 area. It is a big question as to whether it can sustain a move above $60, but we are in a period of global synchronized economic expansion. This is a natural period of time where commodity prices should be doing better because demand is improving against a background where it wasn't particularly expected. So there is the potential that oil prices and commodity prices can do better in this scenario. But I think it is important to realize that this is a cyclical move, that this return to outperformance of cyclical sectors is something that we get in the latter stages of cyclical advances. What we're already starting to see is that interest rates are beginning to rise. Eventually, those rising interest rates will choke off the expansion, and then we will get a recession. There's an awful lot of debt needs to be refinanced between 2018 and 2021, and most of it between 2019 and 2020. So that suggests that all that debt that needs to be refinanced could potentially happen at somewhat higher interest rates. That would impact the ability of both governments and most particularly corporations to buy back their own shares and to increase their dividends, which would impact the consistency of trends in stock markets, and then we could have a somewhat larger pullback. We've been conditioned to expect crashes, because we've had two major crashes since 2000. But in a secular bull market, and most particularly in an inflationary environment where inflation is expanding, that should act as a cushion to prices. And it would suggest that we may not have a crash, that we could have a deep medium-term correction, but not necessarily a crash. And that would also offer a really attractive buying opportunity. I think that it is important to also realize that the Dow Gold ratio has been really quite a reliable long-term indicator for the longevity of secular bull markets, and it has been going up now for about 6 years. But it is capable of advancing for decades, and we are a long way from previous peaks. That would suggest that, yes, we have the potential for inflation to pick up and for commodities to do better, but that is going to be a cyclical advance. That the long-term potential is for stocks to outperform by a significant margin, and that we could have a secular bull market into the early 2030s, and then we get another period of underperformance relative to commodities. And if that is indeed the case, then we really do have to just simply look at stock market indices and ask ourselves just simple filter questions. And is there any evidence of trend-ending characteristics? And in the absence of trend-ending characteristics, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. If we look at the Europe Stoxx 600, which includes the UK and Switzerland and Sweden, then it is bouncing now from the region of the trend mean. And when we look at it on that really long-term chart, we can see that it has been ranging for 17 years already. So it would appear to be only a matter of time before it breaks successfully above 400. And then we get a similar move in Europe to what we've already seen in the USA, that nominal prices should respond to the kind of monetary tailwind in Europe that they did in the USA. Then, if we look at Japan, well, I think that Japan is likely to be the central bank that raises interest rates last. And the Nikkei has been trading below 20,000 really since the early 1990s. It has certainly traded above it on brief occasions, but if the Nikkei can sustain a move above 20,000, then we can conclude that Japan is back not only in a secular, excuse me, in a cyclical bull market, but in a secular one. And the TOPIX index, which is the much broader index, has been ranging below 1750 since 1992. And it is currently about 100 points away from that level. And again, if it can clear the 1750 point level, then the chances are that we are back in a secular bull market for Japan. And I think that it is interesting that Taiwan is leading the way higher. And the Taiwanese and Japanese markets have got a lot of similarities, not least in terms of their interrelationships on the corporate front, but also that Taiwan was among the first areas to benefit from Japanese offshoring, and there are a lot of Japanese companies there, and there's a lot of trade between them, and it has cleared the 10,000 level. This is really, I think, a profound advance. But these are relatively well-developed markets. India has got a lot of catching up to do, and it doesn't have the same very, very lengthy consolidations. It completed that very lengthy range back in 2004. So now it is at 10,000 on the Nifty, and the rupee is appreciating, and inflation is starting to come down, and they have just rolled out 4G across the whole country back in January. And that is likely to have, again, a profound effect, because it is the positive side of technology, which is putting, enabling millions of people that were previously unbanked and illiterate to enter the consumer economy. And you're talking about hundreds of millions of people. And that is likely to to create a really significant economic boost that could continue to benefit the market into the lengthy medium term. And of course, it is all about governance. It is about whether governance is improving or declining. But by and large, in the major population centers in Asia, governance is improving. And I think that it is a big question as to whether governance is improving or declining in China. And I think that we can probably have the judgment that it isn't getting better, but neither is it getting particularly worse. And that is what is contributing to the relatively steady environment that we have on the A-share index over the last year. But what we can also see very clearly on this chart is that China has got issues when it comes to market monitoring. That they really did make a mess of opening the options market, and that flies very much in the face of the perception that they try to create, that they have a pair of steady hands to monitor the economy. They are certainly capable of making mistakes. That is something that we do have to be aware of as the focus of the economy changes from infrastructure and real estate towards services and the consumer and high technology. That is, I think, something that is particularly relevant, and it is worth monitoring the health of the Shanghai Property Index, because the property developers moving to a sustained underperformance would be, I think, a lead indicator for problems. But right now, there's no evidence of it. The index is just testing the upper side of a more than year-long range. And as long as it is trading above the trend mean, then it isn't going to be sounding the alarm bells. So obviously, there are issues evolving that are likely to affect markets. I think that the bond market is where the greatest risk is. And equity, and depending on how inflation is manifested, it could be really beneficial for stock prices in nominal terms. Certainly, we're seeing interest rates starting to move, and that is creating trends in the currency markets. And we are in a synchronized period of global economic expansion, so cyclical sectors like technology and banking and commodities are doing better right now, and that's likely to remain the case for at least the next year. At some stage, we will have a recession, and I think that that is likely to offer really quite attractive buying opportunities. But in the meantime, there's no evidence of top formation development, and if that remains the case, then the prognosis has to be to remain bullish, and that we know what a top will look like. We know what some of the challenges are that are outstanding and that are in the future. All we have to do is to remain vigilant and to continue to monitor the consistency of trends. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.